Welcome to The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW. The Seattle Police Department thought maybe it could predict which officers were extra likely to use excessive force. We'll show you how that program works and why it hasn't worked. That's in a few minutes. First, though, a reprieve for farmers. This week, the Trump administration unveiled a $12 billion bailout for agriculture. It's aimed at easing the damage to the industry from the president's new tariffs and his escalating trade war with China. My first guest is Marcy Green, who is a farmer and the president of the Washington Association of Wheat Growers. Marcy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Are Washington State wheat farmers heaving a sigh of relief at this news of reimbursements?
I would not say it's a sigh of relief. We are pleased that the administration recognizes that we are being affected by the tariffs with China and just the uncertainty in trade, global trade in general. But we really would much prefer having our markets open back up and being able to operate in the global marketplace with a level playing field.
What have these tariffs done to the markets for Washington State wheat farmers?
Well, just for example, China has been an emerging market for Washington wheat. We haven't been a real big player, but it's definitely been a growth market for us. And last year, at this time in the year last year, we had exported 270,000 metric tons of wheat to China, and this year we have exported zero at this point.
And can you blame that on Trump administration tariffs and trade wars?
It definitely has been a large factor in that.
Marcy, you are a sixth-generation farmer yourself, so how personal is all of this to you?
It's very personal. You know, I have two sons who are in their 20s, who are coming back to the farm and want to, you know, make this their life and their living. And we want them to be able to do that. Also, as a sixth generation, you know, I would hate to have our farm fail on my watch. My ancestors have kept it going, so I'm doing my best to keep it going also.
Well, do you think wheat farmers would get, like you, would get enough of this proposed federal money to make up for anything you lose in a trade war?
I don't think it will make up everything. I think it may be enough to keep some farmers who, especially, you know, maybe just starting out, will keep them in business in the short term. But we see this as a short-term solution to a long-term problem. And the real, you know, the uncertainty in trade is affecting our markets, which will, if we lose those markets, it takes a long time to get those back. I mean, and it's not just the tariffs. It has to do with trade agreements, you know, NAFTA and pulling out of the TPP agreement. And with those uncertainties there, our customers are looking elsewhere for alternative sources for their wheat. And if we lose those markets, it can take years to get those markets back.
And Marcy, has all of this affected the amount of support for President Trump for that Washington wheat farmers have? And has it affected your political opinion of President Trump's administration?
Well, I really don't want to talk about my personal opinion, and I can't speak for others. I mean, all I can say is that there are concerns.
There are concerns. Marcy, hang on the line, please, because I want to add to this discussion. Heather Long is with us. She is an economics correspondent for The Washington Post with a big picture on this. Heather, welcome to KUOW.
Hi, good to be here.
First of all, any reaction to what you heard from Marcy Green on the line with us, the president of the Washington State Association of Wheat Growers?
She summed it up incredibly well. I think from what I'm hearing from across the country is very similar to what she said. The concern isn't that they're not going to make it another week or another month that the farm would go bankrupt, but the concern is that they're losing this market share, particularly to China, and that that's going to be that huge growth market for years to come. And if China turns its back on U.S. agriculture, that's really the long-term detrimental impact to the ag business in the United States.
And Heather, do you have any different take or any take on whether this Trump administration proposal, this is a, I believe, a Depression-era system of direct payments to farmers. The Trump administration is talking about a $12 billion sort of bailout for agriculture. How would you weigh the pros and cons of trade war and federal bailout for farmers?
It's really bizarre. A lot of people are looking at this, calling it a band-aid measure, calling it a welfare program. And as you could hear from Marcy, the farmers don't want this. And a lot of policymakers, especially in the Republican Party, have actually been trying to get rid of this program, the Commodity Credit Corporation, for years because they think it's corporate welfare. And so it's just bizarre that Trump is doubling down on this. So last year, that program gave out about $10 billion to farmers, and now Trump wants to more than double that by putting another $12 billion on top to give to farmers. So, at the end of the day, what people really want to see is they want to see some sort of deal made and a huge de-escalation of the trade war that we're in. Instead, the rhetoric that's coming from Washington through the tweets, through the statements today and in recent days is full steam ahead.
Marcy, you just heard the reference. Heather described this as welfare to farmers. Do the farmers in your Washington Association of Wheat Growers group, are they talking to you about concerns that the idea of farmers being on some kind of federal welfare? And do you have that concern?
Well, we don't consider it welfare. We consider it more of a price support system because of political interference in our markets. But yes, I have that concern. And I know that, like I said, I don't consider it as welfare, but I know that word goes out there in the public. And so it causes a lot of problems for us in the public perception of what farmers are doing. I mean, we're working hard, we're doing our best to run our businesses. And then, things outside of our control happen to disrupt our markets. And, in the short term, we're glad that there is this system to help compensate to some extent. Like I said, it may keep some farmers in business during this initial time of uncertainty and turmoil, but we would just much prefer to have our markets opened up, excuse me, opened up and be able to operate on a level playing field with our competitors in other countries.
This is Marcy Green, president of the Washington State Association of Wheat Growers, and also with us, Heather Long, economics correspondent for the Washington Post. Heather, do you have any sense of how the Trump administration would decide which farmers get these direct payments? And could it be political? Would more subsidies go to farmers in swing states, which Washington is not, or states that have Republican congressional delegations, which Washington does not particularly?
There's a huge concern about that. Obviously, the details are yet to come about how this program is going to work. Larry Kudlow, the President Trump's top economic advisor this morning, when he was making the news rounds, implied that the full $12 billion may not even go out. And so, again, immediate questions are swirling. As you said, who's going to get this? How much are they going to get? And is even the full compensation going to happen? I think you're right that a lot of this is politically motivated, and certainly the three key states that are on the mind of the Trump administration and many Republicans in Washington are Missouri, North Dakota, and Indiana. Those states all have key Senate races in the midterm election, and so we'll all certainly be watching because it's likely a lot of money will head there first.
Let me ask both of you then, when President Trump talked about these tariffs early on, he said that farmers would be a big beneficiary of his administration's policy. He said, "We're opening up markets," and he said, "Be a little patient." So first, Marcy, what did you make of that statement from the very beginning? Did you ever think Trump knows what he's doing and this is going to end up being good for farmers?
I can't say that those thoughts entered my mind. I mean, I've had concerns all along because we've known that if you use tariffs, that agriculture gets hit initially. We do appreciate that the president is trying to take care of some problems that have happened in, well, particularly China, in this situation, some trading things that weren't necessarily fair or right. We would prefer to have them go through maybe WTO process or use other things other than tariffs as a way to combat those unfair trading practices.
Yeah, I'll put that last question to you then, Heather, with the Washington Post. President Trump has talked about point, and lots of people have pointed out that China doesn't exactly play fair when it comes to trade. What's your take on the possibility that, as Trump said, be a little patient, and long term, China's going to feel pain and give the United States a better deal, and maybe farmers will eventually be better off, or if not farmers, the American economy in general is going to be better off, and Trump is helping. Okay, maybe farmers pay some of that price, but that's what the price supports, this week's price support idea is supposed to help with. Is there some long game that maybe we're not seeing?
It's an interesting question, and I posed something similar to a number of farmers, and a few of them pointed out to me that, for instance, since Trump took office, he has been able to negotiate with President Xi in China to allow China to start. They have now agreed to buy more U.S. beef products. So before all these tariffs took effect, China, about a decade ago, had put pretty severe restrictions on U.S. beef during that. You may remember the whole mad cow disease debates. And China just never took them off. So they kept restricting U.S. beef and imports into China. And so, Trump was able to lift that early on in his discussions with the Chinese president. And that was seen as a real help in a number of parts of America in the farming community. And so, yeah, I think there is a legitimate hope that something like that could happen again. President Trump often brings up the situation with Canada and the hefty tariff that Canada has had on U.S. dairy products for a long time. So there is a potential and a hope there among his supporters in the farming community. That said, it's very clear from the economic research and just from the reality, we're starting to see it come in as various businesses report their earnings in the last few days, that there is a real hit that's starting to happen to the economy and to certain businesses from these tariffs. So it's that question you were posing, is the long-term gain from potentially better deals going to be worth this short-term hit? That's a real gamble that the Trump administration is making.
Well put, Heather Long, economics correspondent for the Washington Post. Thanks for joining us on KUOW today.
Thanks much.
And finally, Marcy Green, you are again president of the State Association of Wheat Growers, a farmer yourself. Marcy, does any of this, the tariffs, trade wars, now a Trump proposal to reimburse farmers, does any of this affect your summer? Anything you do short term?
It's been affecting my summer all along, even before the announcements yesterday. I was just in Washington, D.C., last week. We're constantly talking with our congressional delegation and with our contacts at USDA and with the administration. And so in that regard, it's already, yes, it has been affecting my summer. As far as on the farm, we're going to keep harvesting our crop and, you know, and just have to have faith that we'll be able to sell it after harvest.
Marcy, I wish you a good harvest. Thanks for joining us on KUOW.
Thank you.
Marcy Green, president of the Washington Association of Wheat Growers and a farmer herself, talking to us on KUOW. And we're going to get into Seattle Police Department trying to predict which officers are likely to use excessive force. And we'll talk about a state of Washington case against Facebook and more coming up on the show. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. How could you prevent a police officer from using excessive force? That's what the Seattle Police Department's been trying to figure out since 2011, the year a federal judge ordered the city's police to reform their department. And SPD thought they had found a way to help fix the problem. Among other changes, they implemented an early intervention system. Just one problem, it might not be working. According to a new study from Washington State University, Crosscut reporter David Croman has looked into this study. Welcome back to KUOW, David.
Thank you.
So this early intervention program, was this something that was specifically approved by the U.S. Justice Department as part of Seattle's reform process?
Yeah, so for a lot of different departments who were under these consent decrees, as they're called, to reform their police department, which basically means that the federal government is making sure that they're following through on these promises, these early intervention systems were kind of seen as a key part of that. So it was in some ways not really up to the Seattle Police Department. The federal judge who came in and the independent monitor came in basically said, you have to do this.
You have to do this. And how does this early intervention program work?
So it's supposed to work that you sort of create these, they call them triggers. So, you know, different things that people at some point concluded might be sort of indicative of an officer that would go on to cause more serious problems. So these were things like uses of force or complaints against them by citizens. And then, you know, when a person hits a certain threshold, a supervisor can sort of, this system will flag a supervisor who will then kind of be able to keep a closer watch on that officer to make sure that they do not actually go on to cause more problems.
Okay, you mentioned a couple of the so-called triggers, complaints lodged against an officer. That might seem to make sense. Consistent instances of an officer using force. And there are a couple of others, right?
Right. So, I mean, there are some big ones like, you know, obviously using deadly force would trigger that. But also things like vehicle collisions. Yeah, like, I mean, just sort of different types of, you know, if they use a hold on somebody, that might trigger it. So I think there's about 15 different triggers that might put somebody on this list to be monitored by a supervisor.
Yes, I remember unexcused absences is on the list, equal employment
right.
opportunity complaints. So various triggers thought to
right.
maybe predict bad behavior, and that officer who's been flagged would go under some extra monitoring. But as I said, this Washington State University study found that program doesn't work. And why doesn't it work?
So what they found is when you measure outcomes, so this officer, that officer, after responding to a call, ended up using force or getting into a collision or something like that. What you're really monitoring, they found, is not so much how skilled this officer was, but the sorts of calls that this officer is asked to respond to. So when you create a system based on these parameters, what you're really doing is you're measuring officers who might be in higher crime areas. And you might have the worst officer in the department who just happens to be in some neighborhood where there's very, very little crime. That person is never going to get flagged by the system. And likewise, you might have somebody who does everything exactly correctly, but they're in a place where they're responding to a whole bunch of calls every day. This system is going to be likely to flag them as potentially going on to cause problems.
How about the experience of police officers? How have they said the system is working or not working for them?
Well, I think people are just have been sort of miffed. So when they introduced this system, it was promised that You know, this is not just because you land on this list doesn't mean that you will be disciplined necessarily. But I think officers end up landing on this list and they feel like they've done everything right, and it still feels like they're being punished for it. And it's not so clean that there is no discipline associated with being on this list, because word gets around and people know, and so that, you know, chances of being promoted might decrease, things like that. And so I think it has caused a real hit on officer morale, at least according to the people that I spoke to.
And by the way, you mentioned in your article the mystery of why this system appeared to be flagging female officers 8.5% more often than men.
Yeah, right. And that was a super interesting statistic that stood out. And I talked to one of the researchers, and she said she actually had no idea why this was happening. But the fact that she couldn't really draw any conclusions about why it seemed to be flagging women officers, to her, got at why it might have some problems.
Okay, so David, you mentioned that this was a federally approved or mandated system. We're talking about this system of trying to flag ahead of time officers who might be likely to use excessive force, an early intervention program, federally approved, but it hasn't worked universally. The LA Police Department had problems with it back in 2014, found that it wasn't working. So why did the SPD go ahead with it?
Well, I think that actually, if you talk to people at SPD, I think there was a lot of skepticism about how the system would work from the beginning, because as it was being introduced in the Seattle Police Department, it was sort of starting to go out of style. Like you said, the LA Inspector General basically found it wasn't worth the effort. And there was similar research coming out of other departments. But, you know, I think there's a certain lag between what is viewed as trendy or something that is seen as an easy fix and what the evidence actually shows. So even after some of this research was coming out, the people who were sort of driving the federal reforms of the police department still thought it was an important thing for the police department to do. So, you know, I think that skepticism was with people in the police department the whole time. But when they started hearing from supervisors who were saying, basically, you know, this system is giving me officers who I know to be doing a very, very, very good job and people that I trust. And likewise, people that I might actually be concerned about are not showing up on this system. When they saw that, they decided, all right, we're going to partner with these people at WSU and actually really get to the bottom of whether or not it's doing anything.
Okay, a couple more questions, David. First, SPD acknowledges this early intervention program's not working. So what are they doing to fix it or get rid of it?
Well, I mean, so they're in this sort of funny position right now where it's not entirely up to them to decide whether they can just ditch this thing, because they are still under federal monitoring of a federal judge. So they have to go back to that judge and say, we think this isn't working. We'd like to try something else. And he would have to say, okay. So that's the first step. And then the second step is, you know, they do support the general idea of having an early intervention system. So it's figuring out, so if these triggers are not working, what are some things that might work? And the Seattle Police Department, their first idea that they've thrown out there is, rather than monitoring outcomes such as uses of force or complaints, we should be monitoring the sorts of incidents that officers are responding to. So, you know, officers who respond to a higher number of stressful calls are more likely to have signs of PTSD. They're more likely to maybe overreact. So if there was some way of cataloging how often an officer is responding to those really high stress situations, they have a hunch that maybe that would be a little more indicative of people who would go on to cause problems.
Okay, possible fixes to Seattle Police's early detection system for identifying police officers who might use excessive force. And last thing, David, the police chief designated, Carmen Best, just had her first confirmation hearing in front of the city council. Anything to report out of that hearing today?
I would say it was a fairly softball confirmation hearing, but the sort of most interesting thing that came out of it was they asked her what she saw as the biggest problem in Seattle Police, and she said hiring. So the negotiations with the union have been going on for a really long time, which means they haven't increased pay for as much as 4 years. So the police department is really falling behind other departments as far as what they can offer. And so as a result, the police department is having a really difficult time recruiting people at a time when they feel like they need to be growing. So yeah, I thought that was the most interesting part that came out of today.
Yeah, pay not rising much while, of course, the cost of living keeps going up in this town. David Croman reporting on all of this for Crosscut. David, good to talk with you again. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is The Record on KUOW. Back in just a moment. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Washington State's Attorney General has won a battle against Facebook. Bob Ferguson announced this week Facebook has agreed to stop letting advertisers exclude minority groups from seeing the advertisements. This comes after the investigative reporting group ProPublica showed how easily Facebook advertisers can discriminate against certain users. Washington State investigated. Now Facebook has agreed to change its ways in Washington and nationwide. So what's this going to look like next time you log on? My guest is Sam Moskovich, who is tech and culture editor at Ars Technica. Sam, welcome to KUOW.
Happy to be here.
What was Facebook doing?
Facebook has been allowing advertisers for a long time to target ads. And on its surface, this sounds like a relatively reasonable idea. For example, I might want to advertise something for infants and toddlers. You may only want people who care about that kind of product to see that kind of ad. However, ProPublica in late 2016 decided to see whether this kind of exclusion could be applied to things like ethnic affinities. That's the term that Facebook used for groups that it could recognize, such as African American, Asian American, and Hispanic. And what that investigation found was that it was very easy to create a housing ad that specifically excluded those quote-unquote ethnic affinities, which violated the Fair Housing Act, among other things. So Ferguson's office decided to run its own investigation over a 20-month span, and that began with them buying 20 fake ads and finding that they were all approved. And they went one further, not just creating ads for housing, but for a variety of different propositions. The one they actually described was a restaurant and excluded specific ethnicities from seeing the ad for the restaurant. That ad was approved. So Ferguson's investigation went on and found other examples of this behavior continuing. Even ProPublica went and saw that Facebook had made promises after their report came out. Facebook had said that they were going to fix all this, and then they didn't. People were still able to exclude a lot of groups from being able to see ads, including military veterans, disabled people, a lot of different groups. And so finally, Ferguson's office said, Facebook, we're going to go the legally binding route to make sure you're not doing this sort of stuff anymore.
I know advertisers want certain groups to see their ad, their target groups, but why does an advertiser want to exclude some groups? Do they save money if their ad is seen by fewer Facebook users?
That's the Facebook proposition, that you are paying for targeted advertising. It's per click, per eyeball kind of payment. So it might make sense if Facebook is saying that and you want to save money to pick people from specific regions or specific age groups. But it can be very easy for someone trying to advertise, for example, in Seattle, a high-rise condo and say, oh, we're going to remove anybody looking for things such as wheelchair access or ramps. And Facebook can identify so many of these properties based on how you post, what you like, and all of that stuff, and feed that information to advertisers, and are very proud of that fact. If you go and try to buy an ad, they have a big sales pitch about all of the data they have about you and how that can make for quote-unquote great advertising.
How does Facebook know a user's race or sexual orientation, religion, etc.?
Honestly, because of the information that you cough up in all of your posts, not just the things you fill out in that About Me section, but the things you like, the things you write about, you can actually go in your profile if you dig through menus and see what Facebook thinks you like. In my case, there is a very weird artistic band called Tortoise that I'm a fan of out of Chicago.
Yeah.
Well, Facebook thinks I'm a big fan of reptiles. I'm not kidding.
Okay. It's not guessing about your religion based on your reptile use.
Right. And what I mean is that the guessing goes all over the gamut in terms of what kind of stuff it tries to find.
Got it. And so what's this agreement? Facebook's agreed to somehow just shut down this tool, so advertisers now have to pay for more clicks?
It's about not excluding people. And Ferguson's statement included particular protected classes, sexual orientation, religious affiliation, and veteran status, and also making sure that no discriminatory filters are applied to things for public accommodations, which means all businesses open to the public, and insurance. So essentially, Facebook has already promised to be more careful about housing ads, and Ferguson's office said, we need you to go one wider for in terms of the protections that we seek for Washington state citizens.
As you said, Facebook profits from letting advertisers micro-target its eyeballs. So is this a major threat to Facebook's funding model or no big deal?
I imagine this hurts to some extent because Facebook has been collecting this data for a reason. They want to sell this concept to an advertiser that when you go to Facebook and you place an ad there, as opposed to television or a newspaper or classified ad, what have you, that it is that micro-targeted. And yeah, Facebook is now having to turn around to some extent for a wide range of content. Now, they've come out and made a big statement saying that they had already they have an announcement saying that they're going to ensure their advertising is safe and civil, and they've had tools in place for some time. But like that ProPublica investigation found, they kept on backtracking, that certain promised fixes weren't really coming through, that exclusionary ads for these specific type of protected groups were able to be passed usually within minutes, kind of robotically auto-approved, that sort of thing. So I can't really speak exactly for Facebook's bottom line, but they've been very proud about that micro-targeting, so I imagine there's some scrambling happening.
Do you have a sense of how likely it is that a Facebook user is going to, now after this agreement, go onto Facebook and see ads that they weren't seeing before?
That's a really good question, especially how you look at Facebook. Again, it's not just Facebook. It's all of their other properties. WhatsApp and Instagram are some of the biggest, and they're trying to monetize. And you'll definitely see a lot of ads on Instagram. Perhaps you'll see more, or perhaps they'll be a little more generic. It's really hard to say, but Facebook has never been shy or slow about getting its ads into as many screens as possible. So I imagine there will be some sort of difference, but I don't think you're going to automatically see a bazillion more ads for condos and other quote-unquote exclusionary groups.
Sam Moscovich is a tech and culture editor at Ars Technica, a fan of the band Tortoise, but that does not necessarily mean he's a reptile freak. It's just that's the way Facebook works. Sam, thanks for telling us about this, filling us in. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Love the show. Have a good one.
Come back then. It's KUOW's The Record, and we'll be back in just a moment. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. I'm glad you've tuned in. By the way, you can jump in on social media. We're on Twitter, live tweeting the show at KUOW. Now, if you will, imagine a stadium built by the patriarchy. Go with me here, okay? Katie and Roni?
Okay. So
with
good.
You, 100%.
Okay. So there.
Some people are fine with the stadium. They're playing along. Others are trying to tear it down. Others have excused themselves from the arena and just started to build their own thing. Mm-hmm. I've got two stadium defectors with me now. Katie Anthony and Ronit Fineglass Plank, they co-host the podcast Mouthy, Messy, Mandatory. You also have a new show on the Young Turks Network called Smart Mouth. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
In your case, Katie, welcome back. Good to see you again. And Ronit, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. So happy to be here.
I enjoy your podcast.
So glad.
Mouthy, Messy, Mandatory. So, Katie, let's start with this. You've said that I mentioned this stadium idea, you know, the stadium that exists and the one we could build on our own. You said that the films Wonder Woman and Justice League are examples of this, what exists versus do it yourself. How's
totally.
That?
So in a conversation about how women are changing the media landscape right now, one of the most important questions that we can ask ourselves is, are we still reacting to rules that have been put into place for decades, centuries, that are kind of part of our social cultural fabric? Or are we creating a new conversation? And one of my favorite examples of this is the contrast between the Amazon costumes in Wonder Woman versus the Amazon costumes in Justice League.
For those who haven't seen it, by Amazon, we're discussing not next day delivery, but the warriors in Wonder Woman. Yes, go on, please.
Exactly. So in Wonder Woman was helmed by a female director and the costumes were designed by a female costume designer. And those costumes that the Amazons wore, this is a race of woman warriors. And these costumes were first and foremost armor. They were functional pieces of equipment that these women needed to do their work. did they also look smoking hot? Of course they did. But that was a...
high boots.
Totally. Well, let's discuss the high boots. Okay. Because the high boot has become a very...
I've seen this in the movie, yes.
Yeah, the high boot has become a very sexualized kind of piece of wardrobe of a woman's, you know, a woman's kind of seduction arsenal, so to speak. But in this movie, you could see that these high boots also had a function, which was that for these Amazon women riding horseback, they needed to be able to protect their shins and knees from blows from an attacker. And so as you're watching this movie as a viewer, as a woman viewer, I remember looking at these women and thinking, yes, they're beautiful. But more importantly, their costumes were designed knowing that they had so much more to offer than just their pleasing appearance. And these costumes are here to serve them in their work and in their kind of identity as warriors.
In battle.
Exactly, okay. In battle. Now, look at Justice League's costume.
I have not seen Justice League. You'll have to help me out.
Me neither. But I looked at all the costumes online.
Okay.
I didn't see it. I heard it was terrible. I'm sorry. But the costumes in Justice League, the women's torsos are exposed. Their midriffs are exposed. Now, I don't know about you, but if I'm going into battle, I want my organs covered, right?
Right.
Like, I don't want my kidneys hanging out there. I want to make sure that I have, like, I'm covered and I'm protected going into battle. And you could just see really clearly, you know, the boots didn't have the armor on them. They were just sexy boots.
Mm.
And there's nothing wrong with a woman wearing sexy boots. But in the case of these two movies side by side, you can really see the difference between having women at the helm where their sole priority is to make sure that these characters can function, and having men at the helm where their sole priority is to make sure that these characters are pleasing. And in Wonder Woman, you can really see these women changing the conversation and, in essence, playing the game in their own stadium.
Well, that has to do with the objectification because, you know, not to overemphasize this, but the male gaze is in Justice League is more prevalent, right? So when you have Patty Jenkins' movie, the new Wonder Woman with Gal Gadot, that the functionality is there because they're in action, they're moving, they have a purpose in life other than to be watched, other than to be sensual. They are doing something, and if you find them attractive, if you find them sensual, that's great, but that's not the primary objective. They have lives, and the lens on them is one of respect, I think, and well-roundedness.
So the sexy boots and the exposed midriffs, that's not just selling to young women who've been marketed to and their parents have been marketed to and the whole patriarchal system, but it's also the male gaze. You think that's the idea is pandering to what men want to see?
Well, think about it. Even if you think about comics, you know, cartoons for kids, okay? And I was talking a little bit before about, I was thinking about the cartoons that kids grow up with and the different roles for women and for men on the cartoons. And a lot of times you'll see in movies, you don't see a man lounging very much or stretching languorously. If it's a superhero, you don't find these moments of repose where they're sort of coyly looking at the camera and beckoning you, right? Mm-hmm. There's not a come hither thing going on. Their momentum and action. And so think about if you dress those male characters that way, the way that women have traditionally been dressed in these superhero movies, it's absurd. You'd say, what's the point of that? That's complete eye candy. There's nothing else going on. And so I really appreciate it when women are given equal treatment and also looked at from a gaze of respect and personhood.
And let me ask you now about your own personal stadium building then. So have you had to work to unlearn, to change your gaze, to change what gaze you care about?
Oh my gosh, so much.
Okay.
Yes.
Tell me, please.
So an example from a show that we just shot for Smart Mouth that's going to be dropping tomorrow. We wanted to do a segment on this new movie that's being filmed in Louisiana right now called Roe versus Wade. And it is a pro-life
extravaganza.
Yeah, it is a pro-life extravaganza.
Pro-life-a-palooza.
I believe we called it a barf bag experience on our TV show. We have a strong opinion about it, but there have been a lot of think pieces about it because the script has been widely leaked. It's extremely inaccurate.
People are dropping like flies when places for filming find out what the project actually is, because it's under the pseudonym 1973 right now. But when they find out that it's a Roe versus Wade, very slanted toward pro-life and unequal treatment movie of the situation, they bail. They kick them out of shooting.
So this is not a political objection you're making. This is a sort of just bad portrayal of the world.
Exactly.
Objection.
But as we were planning this segment, we were trying to have a conversation as we're developing the content. Like, what do we actually want to say about this movie? Mm-hmm. And is there anything that we can say about this movie that's not going to be reactive and that's not going to be beginning within the premise that Nick Loeb, the producer of this movie, should have a right to say what I can do or not do with my body? No matter how we engage with that content, we're going to his stadium that he built, we're playing by his rules, and even if we ostensibly win this game, all we've done is prove what a great game you built.
Yeah, we basically fall for the ploy, right? We take the bait, and then we're talking about his movie and helping to advertise it.
Exactly. And so, you know, we kind of settled on the idea that, okay, they purchased their platform, they rented their cameras, they wrote their script, they hired their cast, they hired their crew, the crew all left, they hired a brand new crew. Mm-hmm. And they bought their platform, but they didn't buy our platform. So instead of digging into all of the ways that this film is awful, we're going to let it do bad all by itself. And we dedicated our segment to spreading more information about why women's reproductive freedom is important. We also highlighted a really incredible organization called Womentum that's like a Kiva giving group. And the really cool thing about Womentum is that they do micro-lending to women in developing nations. But rather than asking those women to then pay back those loans, they ask them to pay them forward. And then they teach these women to like create communities of women entrepreneurs in their hometowns.
So you see what Katie just did? Katie, you brought us all over to your new stadium, and I'm sitting and I have a really good seat, and I think Bill's here too. I think that what you did was take a question about something that we were interested in, and we turned it into something that we're interested in, which is women in media, and it's our gaze. And part of what we did was we also talked on that show, which is airing tomorrow night, about the communications director for Planned Parenthood spoke to Jezebel, that online news source, and basically made a statement about abortion. And this is about reproductive rights. And it's not about life or death as much as it is about saving women and giving them reproductive freedom. And he talked about how the large percentage of Americans want people to have the right to abortion, even if they're Republicans or conservatives. So it was a great platform for us to say what we wanted to say without going low.
Even though we wanted to.
Yeah.
Katie Anthony and Ronit Fineglass-Plank. The podcast is Mouthy, Messy, Mandatory, and they have a new show on the Young Turks Network. It's called Smart Mouth. And you talked about women in media. I remember I thought it was a useful idea when I was in college or so. People started talking about the Bechdel test, mm-hmm. way of looking at women in media. Will you describe what that is, Katie, and how well you think that idea has aged?
Yeah, so the Bechdel test is a test of movies where in order to pass the Bechdel test, there have to be two female characters in the movie, preferably named. They have to talk to each other about something other than men. And so if...
Do women do that?
No, never.
Wait, ever talk about things other than men?
Well, we talk about our hair.
So that we can look good.
And shoes.
Yeah.
For men. Yeah, totally.
Okay. No. Go on. Sorry.
But no, seriously, mm-hmm. if Ronit and I had this conversation, Ronit, it's really hot outside today.
Yeah, it's really hot, Katie.
It wouldn't matter if we were like in gold bikinis chained to a statue of Donald Trump. That would
pass the test.
We passed the Bechdel test, uh-huh. right? And so one really, really interesting example that I didn't know passed the Bechdel test is the movie The Disaster Artist. Just from this last year, this is a movie about Tommy Wiseau, who was reportedly very abusive on the set of his film The Room. The Disaster Artist is about the filming of The Room, and it was made by James Franco, who has now been accused of inappropriate sexual contact by 5 women, 4 of whom were his students. But because 2 women on screen in this movie have a conversation about the script that they're about to perform, the script, by the way, written by Tommy Wiseau, it passes the Bechdel test. And it has somehow found its way into some kind of stamp of approval or half approval by being an inclusive work of art or
Well, what's the mouthy, messy, mandatory test?
I know. I was just going to say, you know, I needed a primer, a refresher on the Bechdel test because my jaw is like dropped. Is that really? That's all it takes?
That's
the
bar.
They need to revisit the Bechdel test. Let's call it, what's the mouthy, messy, mandatory test? Let's do that.
Girl, I mean, I think it's got to be at least as many named women as men in the story.
That's right.
The women have to have interests.
They have to have lives independent of the men.
Yeah.
Arcs. Arcs. We like arcs.
I love a good arc.
I like an arc for myself in real life, and I also like it in my media.
Yeah, 100%. Mm-hmm. Yes. I would love to see also inclusion, you know, behind the camera, so to speak. I'd love to see, you know, a minimum number of you know, like the inclusion writers that Frances McDormand talked about in her Oscar acceptance speech, you know, a minimum number of female crew members, female writers.
Yeah, and when you look at production companies these days, I did a quick look on women run production companies right now, and I just did a smattering of them. And of course, there's Shonda Rhimes, there's Hello Sunshine with Reese Witherspoon, there's Brownstone, which is Eva Longoria, Simpson, which is Kerry Washington, Lucky Chap, Margot Robbie, and Margot Robbie did the Tonya movie. So,
hi, Tonya.
Even when you have a woman at the helm in any kind of capacity, I would like to think that the gaze is a little bit shifted and maybe more even-handed.
I actually have an example of this that's outside of the realm of media, which I think kind of helped me understand a little bit more what we're looking for in media. I have a friend who plays softball, and she has a shoulder injury, and she went to doctor after doctor after doctor after physical therapist, and they kept prescribing the same treatments that weren't working, and her shoulder pain was not getting any better. And she went to a new physical therapist, the first woman that she had seen. And her physical therapist said, I think your bra strap might be exacerbating the condition. And she changed from an over-the-shoulder bra strap to a racer back bra strap, and her shoulder pain was better within a week.
So interesting.
So how can we, and that is something that you would not necessarily expect a male practitioner to think about, because even if he can see, like, oh, well, her bra strap crosses there, he's never had the experience of the discomfort necessarily of right. wearing an
well,
undergarment.
Well, her lived
like
experience.
That.
And of course, this is a pretty great story with a very clear example and a very happy ending. That's a very clear cut and awesome diagnosis. But it's really a good example of thinking outside of the box or outside of one's own kind of confines.
In the public radio world, how important did you think it was that now The Takeaway has, which was hosted by John Hockenberry, he left last year, and then after that we found out about
allegations, right?
Yes.
Well, it's interesting because Tenzina, I remember when Tenzina Vega took over, I had listened to the show before and I liked it. I always listen in the morning for drop-off kids and stuff like that. And people were welcoming her. Guests that came on her show, they would kind of just congratulate her on her new position, and they seemed genuinely happy for her, which I thought was lovely. And I've been listening to her, and this morning, in fact, she was covering Puerto Rico's conquering of Puerto Rico, which I never, ever would have even thought of. And I don't know if John Hockenberry would have brought that to the table. Mm. And I was thinking about how I sort of have an implicit level of trust that she's going to guide me toward the stories that I'm going to be interested in and other people are going to be interested in, with a level of empathy and open-mindedness that I can rely on early on. That's how I feel about her.
Do you ever wonder whether your trust in someone is based at the right level on their relatability to you, their representation, their identity?
I do think so. You know, it may not be the best or most polite answer, but I think that we are human beings, we're animals, and we do feel comfortable around things we know and people we know, right? We're not that different from other animals. And unfortunately, it is the case that if I see a woman on a street late at night, I'm going to feel more comfortable than if I see a man. If I'm talking to someone who understands where I grew up, for example, and they grew up in a similar situation in an apartment, let's say with like a ton of roaches, and they grew up there too. I mean, I might have grown up like that. You know, I'm just saying, like, then I'm going to say, you understand my experience. You know what I'm talking about. And you're not as much looking at the situation from outside. So it's just sort of like a natural response, I think. What about you, Katie?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think, you know, there's a natural defensiveness that comes up when you're relating to someone who is in some ways not like you. Because when they ask about the divergence of the types of people you are, you have to wait and see, like, are you asking to see if I'll confirm who you think I am? Or are you trying to get to know me as an individual? And the more you have in common with another person, the easier it is to say, I believe that you're going to see me as an individual.
Am I hopelessly limited? Please be honest here.
I was going to ask you, how do you feel about being a white man at the helm of the show? These days.
Well, I'm doing my best, and believe me, well, I don't know if I'm ever doing my best, but I'm trying. But internally, as my producers can tell you, you talk to these producers. I asked that question. You know, there's a lot of interviews done by a middle-aged white, you know, cisgender, straight, able. I am who I am. And I wonder, we only have a minute and a half left, so
I
want to hear from
you. Do you have to work harder to make sure people can trust you or earn your position
these
days?
Yes, but I don't mind having to work harder. I think I do. But and I'm also curious if you think that, because I'm looking to you, who do you feel like I'm hopelessly limited as a host?
In some ways, I'm going to disagree with you, Ronit. I'm going to say yes.
Let's go.
In some ways, yes, because you don't have the lived experience of anybody else. And so many of those stories are really emerging onto the forefront as being really necessarily told. But because you have a platform that you are able to share with those people and amplify their message, you also are empowered to really be a game changer, because you can also interpret those stories in a voice and with a face that other people can see as like a valid messenger.
And also, I think you have something really important, which is curiosity. And I think curiosity is one of the most important ingredients to understanding other people and opening empathy. So I think that alone gets you so far ahead of people who are not going to listen or be open.
Well, until they replace me, which might be a good idea, thank you for doing your podcast and thank you for coming on my show.
It was such a pleasure.
Thank you.
Ronit Fineglass-Plank and Katie Anthony co-host a podcast together, Mouthy, Messy, Mandatory. They have a new show on the Young Turks Network. It's called Smart Mouth. Come see us again. Thank you. It's The Record on KOW Seattle. Thanks for tuning in. The show's produced by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Allison Bruzak, Sophie Reed, and Jason Pagano. Our social media producer is Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. Please join us again tomorrow.